to the certain particular aspects that you're interested in, so particular questions you'd like to hear answered, right? I would help. Right?
Just like modernity and academicism, and how we answer the various answers
trying to switch over now as much as possible. They changed the email system over here. It's much better than you see. I like to say, you can't charge. Yes, it's all the load there.
It's one of the best hours.
Really? Wow. Oh, the conservatives are making a comeback, boy. I'm speaking about the way they No. Hamutia a column of quotes all over the world. Making people So is India, which has 900 million people. Right? People won't get much from the advanced stuff. They're not actively getting people. They won't get that. Safer collection from Hasidic sources, I think a number of them unpublished, incidents and shatim, ideas, the whole Chumash and the holidays, just glancing through, interesting things. One Rebbe, I think the name is pronounced Ostropover, probably sitting in Ostropover, and he quoted the halacha in the Mishnah in Megillah, HaKorek es Megillah Mafeya lo yotze. Which literally means, if you read the Megillah out of order, you read chapters 3 to the end, 3 to 10, and then you read 1 and 2. So that's no good. You haven't satisfied your obligation. So he explained it on a different dimension like this. He said, well, I told you so many times, but the way he says it comes out with a terrific punch. When you read the Megillah if you read Ahasuerus's party, and the fact that Vashti is eliminated, and then there's a plot against Ahasuerus's life, and Mordechai discovers it, and Esther reports it in his name, and it's written in the history books. You read that, you don't see any particular significance to those events. They look just like natural, normal, random events. And Esther's chosen queen, I mean, somebody had to be chosen queen. So it's not a miracle every time somebody wins the lottery, even though the odds were 10 million to 1 against winning the lottery. So, that's not a miracle. And then, as everybody knows, you get to the end of the story, and you see that Esther is in exactly the right place to plead on behalf of the Jewish people. And the very night that Haman wants to go in and kill Mordechai, that's the night when the king realizes he didn't reward Mordechai and he resolves to help Mordechai. So then, at the end, you see that everything was really set up. Everything was set up to be prepared for the salvation that had to happen when it had to happen. So then you say, aha, now that I see the end of the story, now I appreciate all the things that happened in the beginning. Now I appreciate that they were really divine providence. So the Astro Papa said, Hakari etzem Megillah lamafreya lo yaksa. If that's the way you read the Megillah, you're not satisfying your obligation. What, you waited till the end to appreciate that those events in the beginning were divine providence? Lo yaksa, that's not the way to do it. You have to appreciate that every event is divine providence even if you don't see the end. Before you see the end. You have to appreciate it as a general rule that applies always under all conditions. If you only wait for the end and then retroactively go back and see that everything was designed, lo yatsa is not satisfying an obligation. That's really beautiful. I read it that way and I sort of say it afterwards, but you have to appreciate it. If that's the only way you can see it, then your attitude is, everything's blank until you show me. I'm waiting. Let's see. You show me? Okay. Then I'll show. Then I'll agree that it isn't blank. But until you show me, everything's blank. Everything's nature. Everything's accidental. That's lo yotze. The person's not satisfied with his obligation, but attitude towards what happens. Still, let's say I take that out. Okay. True. Nothing's accidental. Nothing's accidental. Everything has divine providence behind it. Still, even if I have that attitude, when I see a Ahasuerus's part, and I realize that Vashti was caught, and she didn't come, so she gets eliminated, and I say, it's not random. Nothing's random. Everything is divine providence. Do I have a clue why it's happening? At that point in time, before I get to the end, I really don't have a clue why it's happening. I don't know what role Vashti plays. I don't know what role Ahasuerus plays. I don't know what role the party plays. So here's a good example of knowing what without knowing why. I see the events that are happening, and I know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is guiding the world. Without him, nothing happens. Everything's fulfilling his rock zone somehow. But often, usually, I don't have a clue how. This is the position that we are in with respect to most of what happens. And the tension is that since I don't know why, I'm in danger of losing my sight of the what. If I knew why, then I could appreciate that it's the first world's will that's guiding me. Since I don't know why, so it's easy to lose my vision, lose my clarity that really he's guiding me. But one has to have this balance that you can say the what without jumping into the why, because usually we're not competent to figure out the why. Let's consider as a particularly tragic example, David HaMelech. I don't know if I told some of you a while ago how David HaMelech was born and how he grew up, what his circumstances were. Ruth, David's great grandmother, Ruth was a Moabite Gioris, convert. When she became a convert, there was a question of marrying her. So there was some difference of opinion, because the Torah says that a Moabite who converts cannot be married by a natural born Jew. But Chazal explained that only applies to the male Moabites, not to the female Moabites. If a woman, a Moabite woman, converts, a natural born Jew can marry her. Moavi below Moavia. Okay, so she's female. So according to that, a natural born Jew could marry her. But although that was the halacha in the Sanhedrin, not everybody was convinced. And in fact, if you read the book of Ruth, you see that when Boaz wants to marry Ruth, there's somebody who's ahead of him in terms of the family tree, closely related, and he really has precedence. And Boaz goes to him and says, listen, you're the only person who's ahead of me. If you want, go ahead. If not, knock. And he says, no, I can't. Pen ashkis nachalasi, lest I destroy my inheritance. And those are very enigmatic words. And some say, he's worried. He's worried that he's not allowed to marry her, because she's a Moabite convert. Boaz, who held the other position, and he had the right to, he was the head of Sanhedrin. So the guy says to Boaz, look, you hold the other position, and you have a right to hold it, so you're in a good position to do it. I can't do it, because I don't believe that at all. Fine. So Boaz marries her, and his son is Ishai, and his son is Ishai, and then comes David. Nope, Ishai, following the family tradition of Boaz and Obed, marries a Jewish woman and has a family, has six sons, and then he begins to have doubts. What? Males? No. And females? Yes. Blah, 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 yeah. He begins to have doubts. And it gnaws away at him, because he doesn't know, am I kosher to marry a natural born Jew or not? I don't know. If I don't know, I really should stop living with my wife. I don't know if I have a right to live with her. On the other hand, I have no right to discredit my children. If I go on record that there's been a problem here, then I'll be discrediting my children. They're my children. I'll have the same problem over again. I have no right to do that, because I'm not sure. I'm not sure. If I'm not sure, then I could take measures for myself, but I can't do anything that will hurt my children. So here's what he did. He said to his wife, I can't live with you anymore, because I have this doubt. On the other hand, I can't divorce you, because if I divorce you, then everybody will know, and everybody will figure it out. So we'll stay together as if we're married, but we're not going to live together. Fine. But really, it's not appropriate, if possible, as you can arrange it, it's not appropriate for a man to go without having someone to live with. So he took a female Canaanite slave that he owned, and he freed her on condition. He said like this, if I'm really kosher to marry a real Jew, shouldn't have said natural form, a real Jew, so then I free you, and I'm a completely kosher Jew, and you're a completely kosher Jew, and we can be married. And if being a Moabite, or the child, descendant of a Moabite convert, I'm not allowed to marry a full Jew, so then you remain a slave, and I can live with you as a slave. So he has this arrangement with her, so that either side of the doubt is taken care of. And he's living with this slave. Nobody knows. Nobody knows, particularly with six sons. Don't know, because otherwise it would create terrible doubt for them. Fine. Now, somehow, his wife knows that she has to bear him another child. There are stories like this in the Tanakh, some kind of mysterious knowledge. Probably you have to call it Ruach HaKodesh. Holy Spirit, huh? was Yisha.
Oh.
And the kids are going to be. Yisha's wife knows that she has to bear him another child. How could she do that? He's separated from her. So she tells the handmaid, this Canaanite slave woman, one night she wants to switch places with her. So one night she goes in to Yishai, and for that night she becomes pregnant, and that is David. That child is David. Now, put yourself in Yishai's shoes. Here's your wife, to whom you have not given a get. You've not divorced her. And you're not living with her. And she's pregnant and gives birth to a child. How could that happen? There's only one way. It's called adultery. She must have committed adultery. If she commits adultery, then David is an mamzer. What's politely called in English, bastard. He's a mamzer. This is how David is born. His father is convinced that he's a mamzer and not his child. Not his child. No, he can't. Yishai cannot treat him like the other sons. Even though he can't publicize it because it'll kill the other six. He has no right to do that, but he can't bring himself to treat David like the other ones. And indeed, everybody perceives that six understand, and the others understand, and the family understands, it gets out, that somehow David is different. I don't know why or how, they can't explain it, but clearly, Yishai, being the biggest man in his generation, if he acts that way, then people take it seriously. There must be some reason. So David grows up with a cloud over him, and that's why he says in Tehillim that when anything was stolen from my village, my city, town, they blamed it on me. Because everybody knew there was something wrong with me. Everybody knew that I was, somehow an outcast. So much so that when Shmuel Hanavi, when the prophet said, comes to Yishai and says, God has told me one of your children is going to be king. Gather together all your sons. Yishai calls in his six sons. And he lines them up. And Shmuel goes down the line. He says, not you, not you, not you, not you, not you, not you. God tells him each one, no. He says to Yishai, there is some problem here. God has told me one of your sons is going to be king. And you tell me these are all your sons. And God has said no to each one of them. Don't you have any more sons? Yishai says, no, I don't have any more sons. And Shmuel says, it can't be. You have to have more sons because God told me. So, in confusion, he calls in David. And, shock, Samuel says, that's the one. He's going to be king. You might just as well have fallen from the moon. What are you talking about? He can't be king. He's a mamzer. Mamzer can't be king. It's impossible. So much so, this story is written in detail in the Book of Our Heritage by Kito on the holiday of Shavuos. I recommend that you read it there. It's hair-raising reading. So, so much so that when David HaMelech comes to kill Goliath, there's a war going on. And his older brothers are in the army. And David is a shepherd in the family, taking care of the flocks. The older brothers, who know that he's been anointed, make fun of him. They say to him, you came here because the war is exciting, because you wanted a little action. Go over the sheep, that's where you belong. This is the man whom Samuel the prophet has anointed to be king of Israel. They can't accept it. They know it can't be. It's like you have something staring you right in the face, but your reason tells you it can't be, and you just can't relate to it. Now, this is how David HaMelech grew up. How did he look at it? What did he think about what was happening to him? So this was revealed to me by the Sefer Zaleski, someone with whom I had a great privilege to study full-time for a year, and then when we meet from time to time, he sort of quizzes me, and I shake in my shoes, what kind of terrible error am I going to make? He may be the smartest person I've ever met. It's just overwhelmingly smart. Rosvika Shalevsky. He is just overwhelmingly smart. Brilliant. Anyway, there's a verse in Halal. Ani amayti b'chofsi kola adam kozev. I said in my haste, all man is kozev. So we sometimes meet at funerals. We're walking, you know, behind the mace and walk to the crew. To the thing. So he catches me, you know, sort of asks me questions to see if I'm still alive. And he says to me, what does kozev mean? All man is kozev. So there, Baruch Hashem, I know what the Gong says on kozev, so I was able to satisfy it. Kozev, sometimes it's translated deceit or deceitful. The word kozev in Hebrew means does not live up to its promise. It offers to do something and does not fulfill its promise. Mayim kozvin refers to a spring. A spring gushes forth water, and it gushes forth water continuously, and then if you have a very dry spell, the spring might dry up. That's called mayim kozvin. You expect it, you rely on it, you come to use it, and then all of a sudden it's gone. Mayim kozvin. So, David Allah says, I said in my haste, all man does not live up to his potential, does not fulfill his promise. Good, says Tzvi. So now he says to me, the prophet says, I said it in my haste. Do you think he changed his mind? You think he changed his mind afterwards? Well, if you look at the very next psukim, you'll see right away. The next psukim are, what shall I repay God all the great goodness he did to me? The cup of salvation I shall lift up and with and I will call upon the name of Hashem. I will fill up my vows to God in front of all of his people. These are verses of great joy, great thanksgiving, great appreciation. And it's the same psalm. You stop here in Halal and you say one half, but then you stop and say the other half. But it's a continuation. Continuation of the same psalm. So right after he says, Kol Adam Kozev, all men fail to live up to his potential. Right after that, he says, everything's wonderful, and I owe God so much for all the great, wonderful things he did for me. Said Rav Tzvi, what you see is that David HaMelech learned life the way we learn Gemara. What would you expect a Bishop Rosh Hashiva to do, right? Gemara becomes a template for everything. He learned life the way he learned Gemara. You have a certain amount of information, you try to interpret the information. You form what's called a Havamina. A first thought, a first analysis. But then when you gather new information, you go back and you reevaluate and you change the Havamina and figure out that the truth is different from what you thought. Life, he said, is a sugya. It's a sugya like a sugya in the Gemara. Something about said, on the basis of my youth, I felt in me the potentiality for great ruchnis, for great spirituality. And I saw that my circumstances were so negative, they were so bad, that I did not develop. And I felt that, if I could learn from my own case, this world is built in such a way that people do not succeed in fulfilling their spiritual potential. That's what I said. Ah, but then, when my life went further and I saw what I was supposed to be able to do, the responsibilities I had to take, and to be the leader of a nation, of a whole nation. So then, you have to be able to relate to every part of the nation. It's really not very good if the ruler is born and raised with a silver spoon in his mouth. That's not the best way usually to create a wise and capable, understanding, sensitive ruler. So David HaMelech says, later in my life, I could look back and I could see how each of those terrible pains, terrible suffering, terrible disappointment, terrible frustration, each one of them contributed to my becoming the person that I had to become. So we're hearing that David HaMelech, even King David, in the early part of his life, didn't have a clue. He didn't have a clue why he was going through that excruciating suffering. Surely he did not lose sight of providence. He knew that the providence was guiding his every step. But he didn't have a clue why the providence took that form, in particular that tragic form of terrible, unjust punishment and suffering. And for what? Another example, according to the Zohar Kodesh, Aaron HaKohen becomes Kohen, becomes high priest. His four sons, Nadab, Avihu, Elazar, Aminita, and his summer become priests. Okay. Nadab, Avihu, are trying to kill them. My first son is his son. And their future children become priests. When this happens, Elazar has a child already. Elazar has a child named Pinchas. Well, if you think about the formula, Aaron, his four children, and their future children, that means Pinchas is left out. Pinchas is left out. So it's going to be that the only one in the line from Aaron down through history, the only one left out is Pinchas and his future descendants. That branch of the family is out. Now put yourself in Pinchas' shoes. How do you feel? And no reason is given. No reason is given. You're not being punished for a crime. Nothing. You just, you're out. You have a mark on your forehead. We don't want you. That could be devastating. That could be devastating. Now what happens? Zimri brings the Goyata, and he brings her into the camp in front of Moses and Aaron and Yeshua and the rest of the Sanhedrin, and they're crying because they don't know what to do. Pinchas remembers, he knows what to do. Kill them! Kill them to save God's honor. Save God's honor. Whose honor? The God who put a brand on his forehead and said, I don't want you. I don't want you. Everybody else in your family is included, but not you. You're outside, excluded. That's the God whose honor needs to be saved. And the only one who can be qualified to do it is Pinchas. That is real greatness. That is real greatness. To be the one who's fired with zeal to protect the Kodesh Baruch Hu's honor, that Kodesh Baruch Hu who said, I don't want you, you're out, I'm excluding you for no reason at all, just don't want you. And that's how he earns kulin. He earns it. He's the only one who earns it on his own. And he becomes a Kohen through his own action. How do you get that? You get that by saying, I don't know why. I don't know why I've been excluded. But it's from Providence. And Providence has some good goal in mind, because the Providence comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu who is all good. But he certainly didn't know why. He didn't know what it was for. Now, in a way, we looking at it retrospectively can say, it was for this glorious act of giving from a position of minus, which he brought into the world, he was able to create as a media, as a characteristic of Christ of the Jewish people. But what this illustrates over and over again is that things can happen, and although we are required to see them as Ashgacha, as Providence, we very often do not know why they happen. I told some of you the story about Yehuda Nasi, who, when a calf was being led to slaughter, and it was bleeding and protesting, and he said, why are you protesting? That's what you're created for. You're created to be slaughtered, to be eaten, you know, but that's your fate. Shortly thereafter, he acquired a very serious and painful and distressing intestinal ailment. And he had this for months or years, depending upon the source you take. And then his daughter was sweeping out the house, and in those days, the floors were dirt. They didn't have stone floors or wooden floors. And in the refuse that she's sweeping out, there was the baby mice. And they were squealing. So the Yudanus said, don't hurt them, don't sweep them out. See, the verse says God's mercies extend to all his creatures, including animals. And that's when he was cured from that intestinal disease. Now, did he know why he was suffering? If he had known why he was suffering, he could have solved it much earlier. He could have gone to the local zoo and fed the giraffe. I don't know. He could have helped the animal. Some animal somewhere could have bought a calf on the way to market and then kept it to milk. He could easily have done some kindness for some animal without continuing that awful suffering. It seems clear he didn't know why he was suffering. And this is important. This case is important because you will hear people say that God deals with us, mita keneged mita. He deals with us in such a way that when we suffer, it's because of something wrong we've done. And if you analyze it carefully enough, you'll be able to figure out what it is you did wrong from the type of suffering that you have. So let's see, I have a toothache. It's my third molar on my upper left. Is that lashon hara? Or is that davening without kavana? Or is that not being careful enough in kashrus? Or, brushing my teeth on Shabbos when I forgot? Or, I could think of lots of alternatives. And if somebody insists that God deals with us that way, I want to know what happened to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Why didn't he figure out what he did? Figure out what it was for. Just seems that, although it may be Mita Keneged Mita, it doesn't follow that we can figure out how it's Mita Keneged Mita. It doesn't follow that we're capable of analyzing it. Ramban says that in the times of prophecy, Jews didn't go to doctors. Indeed, it says that anybody who goes to a doctor is an abomination. Why? Because the whole of your physical body, the whole of your physical condition is a symptom of your spiritual condition. Now, you go to any doctor, he'll tell you, don't treat symptoms. Don't treat symptoms, treat the disease. So why would you use an ointment or an aspirin or whatever it is for the symptom when what you really should do is treat the disease? How do you know what the disease is? What is the spiritual root of this particular injury or suffering? So the answer is you go to a prophet and he tells you, this is what God is indicating, this is what you should fix, and then you fix it. Now, usually when I make this point, I say, but now that we don't have prophecy, so we don't know. But someone pointed out to me recently when I told this over, nice thought, that forget about now, what about then? Even then, the only way you could get it was by going to a prophet. That's what's different between now and then. Then they had prophets, and now we don't. But even then, when they had prophecy, you could only get it from a prophet. If you didn't go to the prophet, then you wouldn't know why it was. Why not? Figure it out. Mita keneged mita. No. Usually, even though it is mita keneged mita, it doesn't follow that you can figure out how it's mita keneged mita. It's a nice deduction. Yeah.
Is the difference with the Purim story that even though it occurred over such a long period of time, nine or ten years, that at the end of it all, the fact that everything turned out completely opposite to what was expected and what seemed to be imminent, and the fact that we could recognize it, really separates it from David HaMelech's?
No, because he figured it out at the end of his life. That's why it changes to joy and thanksgiving. As Rashi says, the sugi yava havamin yava maskona. You have what I thought at first was the interpretation of the events, and then later you come back and reevaluate. But the important point was that I said at the beginning is that even though you can't see the why, you have to remember that it is all coming from divine providence. It wasn't an accident because now I see how it came out. You should understand it's not an accident from the beginning. Okay, so now with all these examples, the question arises. What to do? If the events are happening, and we're living in the middle of them, and we don't know why they happen. Okay, this is my problem. It's quite right. But we don't know why they're happening. How can we respond to them? How can we respond to them? What should we do about them? If we don't know why they're happening. Usually, in order to respond to something creatively and intelligently and practically so that you'll get somewhere with it, you need to know why it's happening. If you don't know why it's happening, yeah.
Are events, is the perspective that events are happening to us because God is communicating things specific to us, or are we just caught into a bigger mechanism where events are happening but it's not necessary to communicate to us specifically?
Okay. Before I answer your question in detail, let's just take what I've said, see if anybody can figure out what I've said, and now apply it to your vocabulary. Your vocabulary is, God is making events happen to communicate. your question is only to communicate to the individual or as part of a larger picture. What am I saying? So what should you say about his word? He used the word communicate. Guess what? That he is communicating with us. Well, but isn't that kind of funny communication? Suppose I send you a message in Chinese. Am I communicating with you? Certainly not, right? You don't understand Chinese. I'm not communicating.
There's a message there.
There is even not communicating with you. Communication means you get an idea. I want you to get an idea. An idea to travel from my mind to your mind. Not putting chicken tracks on you, you know, in front of you and saying, here it is, joy. That's not a communication. I'm saying that when the events happen, we very often cannot know why they're happening. So how can it be a communication? It's not a communication. It's events that are happening for our good. Let me ask you a question. You take a four-year-old and you inoculate him against polio. Well, that's what they used to do anyway when I was a kid. You know, they took a big needle, a really fat, horsey needle, and a gigantic hypodermic, and they stuck it in for 25. No, okay, I'm exaggerating. That's what it seems to a four-year-old. Now, are you communicating with a four-year-old? You probably miscommunicate with him. My father hates me, and the doctor hates me. You know, they'll enjoy me seeing me squirm and cry. Like, you're not communicating anything to him. You're just immunizing him against the disease, because he needs to be immunized. Because Baruch Hu is doing things for us and to us all the time, and they all are done for a reason. I wouldn't call that communication if the reason is such that we can't see it, we can't appreciate it, we can't read it. That's not communication. So communication is not the right word here. Now, if you ask your question in a pure vocabulary, in a pure vocabulary where you don't run over that line, do things happen to me because of me, or do things happen to me because of my relationships to others in a larger picture, the answer is there are events of both types. And often enough, things happen to me only because I'm related to a larger picture. Bethesda says, why are the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah? The first day, you're judged on the basis of your own achievements. And the second day, you're judged on the basis of what you contribute to the community. And it could be that if on the first day you lose out, the second day could save you. Because the small picture, you maybe don't deserve. But in the big picture, because you play such an important role vis-a-vis the community, you could be the woman who set up a little room for Eliyahu, for the prophet to when he comes by, the place for him to stay. So he says to her, is there anything I can do for you? To speak to you to the king. And she answers, Besoch ami anochi yoshavis. No, don't speak to the king for me. I dwell among my people, in the midst of my people. What kind of answer is that? So Chazal say that the day was Rosh Hashanah. The day was Rosh Hashanah. Shall I speak to the king for you? Says the prophet of God, shall I speak to the king for you? What an offer. The prophet says to you, you know, I'll be your advocate. I'll put in a good word for you. She says, no. Oh, no, don't do that. Don't single me out. I want to be together with Chalisra. I want the judgment of the whole of the nation to be my judgment. I don't want to be singled out. I don't dare take the chance of being singled out. So definitely, some things happen to us because of what we are as individuals, and some things happen because of our place in the larger picture of things. But don't call it communication, because very often it's not communication. Very often we don't know what's happening. Anyway, so that's true. How do we respond? Now, there's another statement in the Talmud which will appear to contradict what I told you so far. That's why I'm bringing it up. If something bad, something bad happens to somebody, the Gemara says, Yifash Bishmasa, let him analyze his actions. Look for weaknesses in his actions. Look for faults. Look for transgressions. No, I know it's late, and I know you're tired. Where is the apparent contradiction? Why does this appear to contradict what I said before?
Can't figure it out.
Can't figure what out? Say it out in a little more detail.
we can't, even if things are mita connected mita, we're not necessarily capable of figuring out how they're mita connected mita, what the signal is for us, what the message is.
The message would be that this avera, this transgression, is the?
Is the cause.
Right. That's the word I want. Good. Is the cause. In other words, this is suffering a toothache. And the Gemara says, analyze your actions. So, the problem will be, why am I analyzing my actions? I'm analyzing my actions to figure out what the cause of the toothache is, so that I can fix that fault and thereby cure the toothache. But I have told you that very often you can't tell what the cause is. So it does seem that there's a contradiction there. This usually, for those who know something, this usually raises an objection against me. When I say against me, I mean it's all the Gemara that I brought you. I'll be showing you, but right, that you can't figure out the cause. The solution in logic has to be that there's some other reason for analyzing your actions than finding the cause. There's some other reason for analyzing your actions than finding the cause. What other reason could there possibly be? You're suffering. The Gemara says, I want to tell you, whoever it is, George is suffering. The Gemara says, George, analyze your actions. That's what you do. You're suffering, analyze your actions. George says, but you told me I can't find the cause. And the Gemara says, I know you can't find the cause, analyze anyway. How would you describe the reason for analyzing if it isn't to find the cause? What other benefit could you get from analyzing?
Maybe you could change the cause. The cause of your suffering is really lashon hara. But you analyze your actions, you can't figure out what it is, and you think you put it on something else you've done. And then Hashem says, well, you know, you suffered for this reason, and it benefited. Since you, now you're going to correct some other sin, so now you've rectified that transgression. So we. Sort of like transferring the cause of the...
Okay, look, see, he's thinking creatively. That's the way to go at it. So, right, you're not going to the cause, but this has got to help somehow. So maybe you can help if I improve this, because Rome would say, sure, I'm doing it for that, but since you satisfy this, I'll change the circumstances. That's the right way to start analyzing the problem. That's good. I think there's another way to do it, a kind of broader way to do it, but that's the way to start thinking, yeah.
Maybe part of what it's doing is just
so here the thought is, if I understand you correctly, true. Analyzing your actions is not going to solve the toothache. The toothache's going to stay a toothache. But get something good at it. You know, use it for some kind of benefit. The benefit will be a spiritual benefit, even if it doesn't stop the toothache. Also a good thought. But there's a way of saying that analyzing your actions will stop the toothache without saying that you found the cause of why the toothache takes place. Just start thinking around the corner. Now you have to go right angles around the corner and think at right angles to what we've been saying. There's another way to stop the toothache by analyzing your actions and improving something without finding the cause. We don't know the cause. Yeah.
That makes the point. The point is just to analyze your actions and find something.
Okay, that's true to what he said, but then you have no guarantee you're going to stop the toothache.
Come up with all the possible reasons and you'll change them all.
Okay, but then you are going to get the cause, right? You don't know which. Okay, so there's another solution. You don't have to know which one is the cause. Just make a list of all the mistakes. And if you correct all of them, you'll get the cause wherever it is, right? You don't have to identify which one it is if you fix everything. I don't know if it's how practical it is to fix everything, but okay, it's a similar idea. Now, yeah.
Maybe it's really just a pile up of a bunch of layers. And if you take one away.
That's a terrific thing. Right? Maybe it's a combination of 10, and I can knock out any one of the 10. Then there's only 9. With only 9, I don't deserve this particular punishment. Very good. The thinking is very good tonight. Here's another way. Somebody is out to kill George. And he knows this because he gets threatening letters in the mail, and suspiciously his windows are blown out from time to time while he's sitting by the fire, and the bullet misses him by a few inches, and as he gets out of his car and goes into the building, his car blows up, you know, and he misses it by 10 seconds, right? Of course, there's a little blood in that one because the air is blown up too, but anyway, you know, somebody's out to get George. Now, how can George protect himself? There are two ways. There are two ways George can protect himself. One is, hire a detective. Find out who the guy is who's trying to kill him and get an Apache helicopter over there and blow him up. Right? That's one way. The other way is for George to hire a protection service. Protection service. People who surround him. Bodyguards. Right? You don't have to know who the killer is. If you set up a protection so the killer can't get through, so then the guy can't get you even if you don't know who it is. So if Yifash Mishmanasav could mean analyze your actions, build yourself up, improve yourself to the point where even if the cause is still there, even if the cause is still there, you don't deserve to suffer. Because your positive record is so overwhelmingly good. Or better, even that might not be quite right, often enough, Kyle says this, others say this, if a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants something to happen to somebody, and it involves some kind of suffering or loss, if the person is perfect, nothing can hurt him. It's not, according to the rules, if he's perfect, nothing can hurt him. If he's not perfect, then he's open to be hit. Now I shall be hit him. That depends upon what the world needs. It might depend upon what the world needs. Not that he needs this, but so if he were perfect, you couldn't hit him at all. But once he's not perfect, you can hit him, and you can hit him in a way that the world needs. So, for example, Moses. Moses didn't go into Eretz Israel. Now, if you ask why, you get two different kinds of answers, both of which are true. One is, he was supposed to speak to the rock, and he hit the rock, or what he said when he spoke to the rock was the wrong thing to say. He failed that test. And not going to Eretz Israel is a punishment for failing that test. It says so several times in the Chumash. In other words, why was he liable to a punishment? Because he failed that test. But others ask, why was the punishment not going into Eretz Israel? There are lots of ways to punish a person. Why this specific punishment, dying outside of Eretz Israel? Well, some say because everything Moshe Rabbeinu did is permanent. Nothing he did could be destroyed. That's why the vessels that when the Babylonians conquered the temple, the original vessels of Moses were put away beforehand. They were hidden away. They were not captured. They couldn't be captured. Not what Moses did. That's why what the Babylonians conquered was not Moses' tabernacle. Couldn't conquer the tabernacle. It was impossible. But that's what Solomon's temple. Okay, Solomon's temple could be conquered. Whatever Moses did, if Moses had come into Eretz Israel and supervised the division of Eretz Israel among the Jewish people, then we could never have gone into exile. Ah, you say, that's great. What do you mean? That would be terrific. Why? The answer is because there are times when the decree was so great against the Jewish people that there were only two alternatives. One was exile and the other was annihilation. And exile is the escape valve. That when there is that drastic decree due to a drastic failure, there, the Rebbe says, well, since I can send you out to exile, so therefore I won't destroy it. Had Moses conquered the land of Israel and distributed it among the Jewish people, exile wouldn't have been available and there would be no escape valve. Now, that means that the reason the punishment took the form of not going into Eretz Israel was to protect the Jewish people when they will fail, so they'll have an escape valve. So, if he had done nothing wrong, you couldn't have punished him in any way at all. Once he did something wrong, the punishment takes the form that the Jewish people need. Not necessarily only dictated by the particular crime that he committed. The same thing is true here. Yifash v'masav can mean, if a person is hurting, if a person is suffering, there's got to be some chink in his armor. Because if his armor were complete, if his defenses were complete, nothing could get through. Nothing could get through for any reason. So don't look for the cause of the suffering. Look for the chink in the armor. You're not analyzing what caused it. It could be caused by any number of considerations. Maybe I have a toothache because one of the students at a yeshiva just became a dentist and he needs practice in dentistry, so my toothache will be his practice in dentistry. Maybe. Only, I must have done something wrong to have a toothache, otherwise I wouldn't have a toothache. Still, look, why have a toothache? The why you have a toothache may have nothing to do with what you've done wrong. That may be for the dentist. So, but look for your failures, because your failures are the chink in your defenses. They're the hole in your defenses which allow the suffering to get through. So these are a number of ways to explain why you would analyze your actions when you're suffering without assuming that you could figure out what the reason for the suffering is. Yeah.
How does your first answer before the example of Moshe Rabbeinu, how is that distinctly different from what Meir said about as long as you examine your actions, and if you find something that you want to improve about yourself and do teshuva, it may not be the exact thing that you're suffering for, but at least it brings you to some kind of teshuva. How does that differ from what you said, I didn't hear it?
Yes, the difference is this. When the Torah says, when a person sees the suffering is coming on him, let him analyze his actions, there are two general ways to read that. Analyze your actions so that you can stop the suffering, or analyze your actions, because it's a good thing to do, and it will give you auxiliary benefits, and you might as well make use of what's happening in the best possible way, but there's nothing to do with stopping the suffering. Now, if you say it's only for auxiliary benefits, then it doesn't even begin to contradict what I said, that you can't figure out the cause. But you're not trying to stop the suffering at all, so of course you're not figuring out the cause. My goal was to allow the strong reading. Yes, you're analyzing your actions in order to stop the suffering. And then ask, well, if you're doing that, how could you do that if you don't figure out the cause? And to show that there are ways to do it, analyze your actions with the hope of stopping the suffering without figuring out the cause. So several people have gave different suggestions as to how that could work. It was a very, very creative thing, very creative and very, very, very well focused. And as you know, I don't always say that, so because it isn't always true. Okay, yeah.
There would be times that, like with Moshe, where he knew the reason that he wasn't going to go in. So even if you were to figure it out, there's times where you're not going to do anything by it, no matter what you do.
I was going to give Moses an example of the opposite. Moses davened 515 times to go into Eretz Yisrael. Did he know that that was futile? Surely not. Surely not. We are not in the habit of banging our heads against the wall. It's not. If he had known that the decree was absolute and final, he wouldn't have. Indeed, what did the Kodesh Baruch Hu tell him? Stop davening about this! And he stopped. He didn't keep davening. So it means that when Kodesh Baruch Hu told him the first time around, you're not going in, he certainly did not know why. He didn't know the seriousness of it. He didn't know the gravity of it. He didn't know that it was absolute. He was ignorant of that. So he died 15 times. So Kodesh Baruch Hu said no. All right. Now, we are facing what looks very much like a war next week. How should we deal with this? How should we respond to this? I would suggest, on the basis of what I have told you, not by trying to figure out why it's happening. That's not the spiritually creative response. Not by figuring out, what does George Bush really want? Does he really want the freedom of the Iraqi people? Does he really want to destroy weapons of mass destruction? Does he really want to guarantee the flow of oil and the price of oil so they didn't have to work? Does he really want to democratize the whole Arab world? I really don't care what he wants. It doesn't concern me, it doesn't affect me. And, I believe, not to figure out, is this the war of Gog and Magog? Is the Mashiach coming right after, or is this the devil, or whatever? It's a sudden stirring up trouble. That's not what's it. There are two crucial things that we need to do, I believe. One is, as I said at the beginning of this year, we have to keep in mind that it's all providence. Will Turkey give America a basis, or will Turkey not give America a basis? If it's an invasion from the north and the south at the same time, you're going to split the Iraqi defenses, it'll be much easier. If it's only from the south, it's more difficult, and on and on and on. That's not where it's at. That's not where it's at. It's not north, and it's not south, and it's not the cruise missiles, and it's not the bomblets that they now have, which they drop on parachutes, and then when the sensors sense heat, they go shooting off in different directions to hit each tank separately, and the ones that have your name and address. And the ones that give out bursts of radiation, which will blow out all the computers without killing anybody, because it's just electromagnetic radiation that ruins electric circuits. You know, that's not where it's at. Everything is run by divine providence, and every missile and every bullet and every electromagnetic wave, every one of them is governed by divine providence and will find the target that Akash Baruch Hu has designed for it. And to remember at every moment that that's what's going on, number one. Number two, the Torah tells us, and Chazal emphasize, that everything that happens in the world happens because of the Jewish people. We are the hub. Everything revolves around us. So, as Chazal say, when great destruction comes into the world, it comes into the world to remind the Jewish people of what the stakes are. Just like when there's a loud clap of thunder, everybody jumps. And then you make a bracha because that thunder reminds you of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power in the world. Great tragedy, great suffering among human beings in general serves many purposes. But one purpose it serves is ultimately to remind us of what the stakes are in the world. And to have a kind of at least one half I can say. To remember that because it all revolves around us, what we do is really crucial. What we do is really crucial. Now, nobody knows whether Eretz Israel is in danger or not. It's conceivable that there is quite considerable danger. It's conceivable there's no danger at all. Very hard to know. The bottom line is that what we do is what determines what the outcome will be. So, if there is a war, to add to one's hours of learning, to daven with more attention, with more focus, to realize, say, Sim Shalom, please put peace in the world, and please on your people, Israel, especially, that we should have in mind that our tefillah, our prayers, are what are going to be counted in determining what happens in the end. Diktuk of mitzvos, care and precision in the fulfillment of mitzvos. These are the things that we should try to have in mind. I'm sure that the Anhala of the Yeshiva will undertake some special measures that would be appropriate for such an eventuality. And to keep in mind that because it's divine providence, because we are the ones who are most closely related to divine providence, that what we do is really crucial. And in terms of the domestic war, I can't say what Chaim Shmulevitz said in the 1973 war. He said a Jew has to have in mind two thoughts which could stand in tension with one another, and you have to work hard to keep them both in mind. Number one, you have to realize, you have to have an attitude and express gratitude to the Israeli soldiers whose lives are on the line and who are on the front protecting us, facing bullets and facing bombers and facing anti-tank charges and dying, to protect us. One has to have a sense of gratitude, and one has to be able to express the sense of gratitude, together with realizing that ultimately what happens depends upon us. Because we who keep the Torah, represent the Torah, study the Torah, we are the ones whose actions really determine the outcome. So, you see, you can feel a certain tension here. If it's really us who are determining the outcome, so why should I have any gratitude to them? But that's not correct. If they are the long arm, if they are the vessel that's chosen to work the outcome, then we are required to have a gratitude and show gratitude to them, together with understanding that it's we in our actions that determine what the outcome will be.